Bring the Environment, Natural Resources, and Energy Committee to order. Representative Faulk, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have.
Representative Faulk moves the minutes. Anybody have any comments? All in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Representative Beard.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. I'd like to move House about 2650. Mr. Chairman, I believe we're working from the House file and not the Senate file. Or remind me what we're doing here.
Representative Beard moves House File 2650 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
General Register, sir.
Representative Beard.
Members, we have, and I don't have my packet in front of me. Do we have two amendments in that file as well, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Beard, you have A1 and an A2 amendment. Which one would you like, A1?
Ah, here we go. Now I've got it. Mr. Chairman, if we adopt these amendments, it'll make the bill very similar to what action the Senate took. So over the last couple of weeks, the Senate has held extensive hearings on this proposal and did adopt two amendments. Before I do, though, if I may, let's talk a little bit about the genesis of the bill and why it's even in front of us this morning. Many years ago, there was the Renewable Development Fund was created out of the discussions concerning Prairie Island's 1994 petition to the legislature to create a dry cast storage pad at its plant in Red Wing area. The Renewable Development Fund was sort of the price that was paid by the utility, the price that was extracted, as I prefer to look at it, by the utility that had the prescience to actually build a nuclear power plant, and of course they actually had the audacity to believe the federal government was going to create a repository for spent fuel. When the feds didn't, of course, come through, the plant's nature being as it is, there was spent fuel that had to be accounted for and accommodated in some fashion, so dry cast storage was developed, and of course those sit on a pad in Prairie Island Nuclear Power Plant to this day, and now in Monticello. Part of the process of negotiating a political solution to an engineering problem was to develop a renewable development fund where money was extracted from Xcel ratepayers, because Xcel owns the power plant, and was deposited or directed, actually, and this is part of the problem, to be spent in a host of situations, mostly around renewable energy or electrical energy. That was the thought. Over the years, that fund has morphed many times. I think we've had that hearing here and in the Legislative Energy Task Force Commission, we call it now. All kinds of things have been done with that. And so a couple of years ago, the Legislative Audit Commission asked the legislative auditor to look at the Renewable Development Fund, how it's created, how it was administered, what goes on with it, and just kind of give us some recommendations on how this thing could be done better. The legislative auditor did come up with some suggestions and findings. They're encapsulated in this marvelous report from the OLA members. There were just a couple of things that he really thought needed to be done. And while not talking to the policy, speaking to the execution of the policy, one of the biggest things he pointed out to us was not that the fund was illegal. Pretty much it is extra legal or non-legal, I suppose, is the best way to put it, because the money never becomes public money. There just is a statute that requires a private company to create within its own private treasury an account that we tell it what to do with it. And nowhere else in state government do we do this, only with Xcel Energy and only with the RDF. There has been some discussion over the last couple of years. The result of that report, first of all, resulted in a moratorium which expires on July 1st of this year that said all payments will stop from the RDF fund until we at the legislature have a chance to figure out how we want to restructure the fund and how we want to streamline and bring into good practice the things that we require of that fund. So House File 2650 is the result of that, and with the amendments we'll put on, it's the result of 2 weeks of discussions in the Senate that I think, take steps to get probably 80%, in my opinion, of what the legislative auditor was looking for. Mr. Chairman, first I'd like to move, I believe it's the A1 amendment. Is that the one that starts on line 2.23?
Representative Beard moves the 2650 A1 amendment.
Okay.
Like to speak to the amendment?
Well, okay, I just covered them up here, Mr. Chairman. Now I've got them in front of me again. Now, the A1 amendment is the one that I'd like to move. And, Mr. Chairman, it's, I think, just tightens up the language that says that the Public Utility Commission is the one that can approve the administration not to exceed 5%. That was one of the recommendations of legislative auditors, that we had no limits on what could be spent for what. And the cost of administering the fund was one of those things that the auditor referred to. The A1 amendment addresses that specifically. They can authorize the Public Utility Commission to approve up to 5% of the funds to be accounted for administration of the RDF by Xcel Energy.
And Representative Beard, this is same language as in the Senate bill.
Yes, that's what I'm told.
Thank you. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just have a question for Representative Beard on the first part of the amendment. How is near commercial and demonstration scale defined? What is the rationale there?
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking here for my notes from the Senate discussion, but what I do have with me is a witness who sat through those several hours of meetings, Mr. Evans from Xcel Energy. Perhaps he could speak specifically to the near commercial and demonstration scale language.
Mr. Evans, please signify who you represent and your name for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. The amendment on page 2, line 24, has to do with there's a list in that section of things that the RDF fund can be spent on. And on line 24, the original language says near commercial and demonstration scale renewable electric or electric infrastructure efficiency projects. And it was the intention when that was written that the qualifier near commercial and demonstration scale would apply to both of those things, but there was some lack of clarity. Some folks felt in the Senate. Mm-hmm. So the addition of the near commercial and demonstration scale a second time in that sentence is to make clear that it's near commercial and demonstration scale renewable electric or near commercial and demonstration scale electric infrastructure efficiency projects. And so the term is not defined, but it would be essentially part of the consideration of the Public Utilities Commission in deciding whether grants should be made, whether the proposed grant meets that qualification.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that's my question because, as we just heard, this is an undefined term that we're putting in. So I don't understand the purpose for putting an undefined term. I think any person could be very subjective in their discussions or interpretation of what near commercial and demonstration scale means. Is it for a small residential solar project? Is it for a large commercial wind farm? Is it for a large biomass facility? I mean, we don't really know, and as with respect of being commercial, is it just because it's for resale to some entity? Is it technology that maybe it's not the first one being rolled up, but it could be the first one in an area? This is so vague and ambiguous that I just wonder why it's being put in there, because there's really no way to subjective. I mean, it's totally subjective in the eye of the beholder.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Falk, in the investment community, these terms have very clear and definite meanings. This is not research and development. This is not pure science for the sake of science. All very important things. But when we're talking about investing the ratepayers' money in things that actually have a payoff in the nearer term, these terms actually do have meanings outside of the legal community and the investment community. And I think the response here was that we were trying to tighten this down from just money for every idea that somebody had, which might have merit, it was felt that if we're trying to actually put useful product on the grid, it would be better to tighten it up to something that had a window of probably less than 24 months or whatever near commercial means. It means it's almost ready to deploy, or there's a beta project or something going on that you can actually put in the ground and actually do useful work with. This deliberately and specifically carves out research and development that may be in, just testing theories and things like that.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, are the projects that are described here or anticipated here ones in which Xcel Energy currently participates?
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, we do some of these kinds of projects. An example I would point to would be along the University Avenue corridor, where because of legislation that was passed several years ago, we were permitted to do some things that are out of the ordinary for our typical business of providing electricity to our customers in order to do some demonstration projects and some of that sort of thing. Those would not all necessarily qualify under this language for a grant. Those are actually, you know, we are able to pay for those through other money in the company and build those into our rates, which was the purpose of the legislation several years ago to allow us to do that. So we would not be precluded from applying for grants under any part of this statute, but we're not precluded, but we don't currently do anything that actually receives money from the RDF, I don't believe. The other thing I guess I would point out is the reason for the qualifier of near commercial and demonstration scale was a concern that Xcel Energy, or anyone else for that matter, doesn't go off on an electric infrastructure efficiency project that would be of a grand scale, that would be part of our system, where we'd essentially be trying to pay for our system out of RDF funds. We wanted to limit it to small projects, which is what this fund is for. So that was the reason why there was some concern about inserting that additional qualifier in there.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, I was trying to think back to the auditor's report, and it seems to me the highlighted legislative involvement of projects, and I think there was one about 10 years ago, Representative Beard, kind of a big one, that wasn't quite near commercial or demonstration level, and I don't think it's been demonstrated yet. That was the Excelsior project, Representative Beard, and I'm just trying to remember that project, and would something like that be prohibited under the amendment that you're offering right now?
Representative Beard?
Mr. Chairman and members, probably not. In this regard, the project that as a freshman I was asked to carry 10 years ago in this whole discussion, it was a fascinating time, was authorized to apply for. It was not ever directed, and I just want to clear the record on that. It was authorized to apply for a grant from the RDF fund, and they did, and the PUC awarded the fund. I think it was $2 million a year for 5 years to develop the EIS and all the infrastructure in the fond hope that perhaps they could actually find a power contract and actually produce useful energy for the grid. That hasn't worked out to this day. However, they're not precluded from applying to this fund, anybody like that even, that actually has near commercial or actually useful things that could happen, whether or not the PUC would approve it again, or whether or not the advisory group, which is codified now in this legislation, would approve that, that's up to them. The important thing is the legislature is carved out of that process. That's the important thing. The important thing in this bill is that it actually takes the nebulous concept that people of goodwill and good faith actually put together, and frankly, even according to the auditor, did a fine job of doing it, absent specific statutory authorization or direction, and it codifies that in statute. So we actually accomplished some of the recommendations of the auditor with that also, and that the advisor group is now in statute, and the relationship between Xcel and the PUC and the application process is now codified in statute should this bill become law. But would they be willing to apply? Representative Hansen, anybody can apply, and I'm sure that project could have applied as well. Would it be approved again or not? I don't know.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, so that was $10 million of the RDF fund to a project that hasn't produced a watt of electricity yet. Mm-hmm. And we have an amendment here that is trying to clarify you. What's your opinion? I mean, do we need to be more explicit in amendment to prevent boondoggles from occurring in the future, or what's needed from Xcel's perspective?
Kevin? Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, one of the things we think is the strongest part of the bill is the attempt to move away from the practice of sort of legislative appropriations from the fund. The Xcel Energy and Advisory Group grant-making process has not occurred for 4 years, and the reason it hasn't occurred for 4 years is because there's no money left in the fund. It's been removed by various acts of the legislature, all for, you know, good projects in someone's mind and for well, in, you know, good intentions, but we haven't had any money in the fund to actually do the process that the fund was set up to do. And so one of the stronger parts of this bill, it from our point of view, is that it takes that, it tries at least to the extent that you can control future legislatures, and I understand the problems with that, but it at least sort of lays the marker down that we're going to run this through the advisory group process and through the Public Utilities Commission for the purposes that are now much more explicitly stated in the bill. I hate to disagree with my author, but I will say that I'm not sure that a project that dealt with burning coal for energy would qualify under any of these paragraphs. They certainly could apply, but I'm not sure that the Public Utilities Commission, absent that specific legislative direction that they felt like they got, would be able to apply for these. They could apply. I'm not sure that they would qualify under the terms of this statute.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hansen, thank you for this line of questioning, because you're reminding me of all kinds of things that happened a decade ago, one of which was my good friend and folks that I work with on other things were adamantly opposed to the provision that I carried in that bill, which put us in some interesting and awkward discussions. But that was specifically designed and in statute as an innovative energy project. It's coming back to me now. Remember that fascinating discussion about how in the world coal could qualify? The legislature actually monkeyed with that. That was in my bill, that it was an innovative energy project that could qualify should the process work and all that and so on and so forth. As I understand the bill as it's written now, that does not qualify. And again, near commercial and demonstration scale means things. A 600 megawatt project is probably not near commercial and probably not a demonstration scale. That's a full-blown power plant. And do we need more of them? I'm looking forward to the day when we do. That is not the nature or the gist of what this bill does, however. So, yes, we put that in law. I carried the bill. I've told you that before. I'll tell you it again. And it was defined specifically as an innovative energy project. That language I don't believe is in this bill. So in that context, no, I don't think it would apply.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I still have the floor, but I mean, I was working on the line of questioning about the terms that are in the amendment. Mm-hmm. And I guess the Representative Beardy made allusion to the fact that the investment community looks at near commercial and demonstration scale differently than perhaps the legal community would, or maybe the legislature would. But when we're putting this into the discretion of the Public Utilities Commission, because even though in the case of the grant that was awarded for the Excelsior Energy project, they took the legislative direction to mean something. They took that to go and say that we have to approve this project, we have to approve that grant. And so even though there may have been the rationale of a grant behind it, because of the legislative directive, the commission felt obliged that it had to follow that area. And so when we're looking at these terms, and if the commission is going to follow legislative directive, how do we know what they're going to use for a criteria? Because we're getting into a lot of very subjective terms here, and it's just an interesting, I want to know the reasoning behind why this is the way it drafted is.
Beard?
Mr. Chairman, I was looking in the audience for Mr. Haar from PUC, the only other person I think that could speak to it, because I am not a lawyer. I'm not an investment advisor. If you read MinPost, you probably don't want to take investment advice from me. And I didn't even play one in a high school play one time, Representative Falk. But I'm looking past you at Mr. Eloff, perhaps as someone who helped craft this language. He'd be better able to speak to this than I would.
Mr. Eloff, would you like to weigh in on this?
Not particularly, Mr. Chair.
I didn't think so.
I will
Thanks
say
a lot, Representative Beard.
I will say on my own defense that the Senate crafted this language, though, so we can all agree in blaming them, I think. I understand Representative Falk's point in terms of a hard and fast definition for your commercial and demonstration scale. But I also agree with Representative Beard's response and that and Mr. Evans as well, in that this was meant to exclude the more research and end of things from being funded here. And I think the language does that. On the margins, yeah, I believe there probably may be some disagreements. It's certainly better than having nothing in there, which would include potentially all kinds of projects.
Thank you. Representative Falk, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to put my comment on the record, I think this is incredibly ambiguous. It's very subjective. I think it could be tightened up. I don't know if right now is the appropriate time to do it, but we've had a lot of assumptions as to what this could mean, and it's clear that none of us can put a very concrete definition on it, so maybe we can work to go and shape this to be a little bit more precise, because I think we know what we're trying to achieve, but the means about of which that's being done are pretty undefined at the moment.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been talking about number four in this list under D, but I want to look at number two, because it seems to me that while you could discuss the boondoggle of Excelsior under four, that you could and say maybe no, but why couldn't you say maybe yes under two?
Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair, I'm puzzled as to what list we're working
maybe
from
you could,
here.
Maybe you could be a bit more specific, Representative Wagenius, of what sheet you're looking at here. And
okay,
what we're
I'm
talking
I'm
about.
I'm looking at line on line
of the bill.
2.19 of the bill, okay. Yes. Number two, because we were talking about number four on line 2.23, so I'm just back up a couple of lines. Line 2.19, to promote the startup, expansion, and attraction of renewable energy projects and companies within the state.
Mr. Chair, the question is again.
Well, I thought I understood that you said that the boondoggle of Excelsior would be excluded under number four, but could it be included under number two?
Representative Beard?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's the purpose of the A1 amendment, which we haven't voted on yet, by the way. When this bill moved through the Senate, the language between the House file, which you're looking at here at the moment, unamended, and the Senate file were the same. The discussions they had over there while we were doing other things here, they met deadlines there so we could bring this up this week. You know how the process works. One of the things that came up, and I'm looking at the notes, my own personal notes from conversations with the Senate author, was this was offered in response to concerns by the Isaac Walton League, Fresh Energy, and the Department of Commerce, that the bill as written was too broad, and they were trying to narrow it down. So the A1 amendment actually is a limiting amendment. Just a sidebar, Mr. Chairman, I indicated there were two amendments. One of them was the second part that had the 5% cap. So these have actually both been incorporated into the A1 amendment. I misspoke. There's only one amendment that I'm offering this morning.
Correct.
Back to Representative Wagenius's question. This was an attempt actually to reach some accommodation for folks who were interested in narrowing up the bill a bit, which is why I'm offering the A1 amendment here this morning, so that it adds the words near commercial and demonstration scale, and I'm not going to try to define those any further than we've commented on this morning, in order to make sure that we can't end up building full-scale baseload power plants out of this fund. That's not what it was intended for, and that's the purpose of the A1 amendment.
Representative Wagenius, hold on 1 second. I think Mr. Eloff wants to shed a little light on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In responding to Representative Wagenius' question, I would point out that under number two, it speaks of renewable electric energy projects. And however innovative the Mesaba project might have been, I don't think anybody would claim that it would be renewable. So
correct.
Disqualify under that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, hence the special language we crafted, innovative energy project. Yes, exactly.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I distinctly remember folks calling Excelsior renewable energy because coal is renewable. I've heard that again and again and again. So then maybe I'll ask the question in a different way. Could coal projects qualify under, and your this amendment is for number four on line 24. I am looking at line 2.19, and it doesn't seem that that's being amended in this bill, or unless I have the wrong A1 amendment. So I'm looking
just
at
a moment here, page 224. Yes. Okay, I'm sorry, now I'm with you again. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm looking at lines 2.19, which does not appear to be amended under the A1 amendment. Am I correct about that, or am
correct.
I missing something here? If I could, Mr.
That's correct.
Chair.
That's correct, yes.
All right. Then, under this, number two, because it says to promote the startup, expansion, and attraction of renewable energy projects and companies within the state. That's huge. That's broad. It's much broader than number four. So my question is, could a coal facility, if it were a renewable or clean coal facility, be funded under number two on line 2.219?
Representative Beard.
I think, Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, elsewhere in statute, there's a very clear definition of what constitutes renewable. Again, back to 10 years ago, coal, the only time I heard the word coal and renewable in the same sentence was when it was being used derisively, mostly by my environmentalist friends on the left. It never came from my mouth or from anyone else's that I recall. That's why we had to redefine the whole concept as innovative energy project. And if you remember at the time, we were looking at a deficit because we hadn't had the Great Recession and all that stuff and the need for baseload power. If you want to continue talking about that, we probably can, but that's not the purpose of the A1 amendment. Although a thought is occurring to me, Mr. Chairman, at this very moment, given what's going on in the blogosphere, perhaps this would be a good time to point out that the little amount of stock I bought, a couple thousand shares in a renewable energy company, was actually purchased because they were a renewable energy company working on biomass. Let me just get this off my chest, if I may, members. That happened when they were actually codifying and trying to come to production commercial scale application, standardizing the definition of biomass and how biomass fuel would work. They only went to coal later after other things happened. Completely without my knowledge or assent, it just kind of happened that way. They found some sort of a gasification technology. Oh, by the way, completely unrelated to this, but just in case somebody's going to say, Mr. Chairman, that this is a door for a little renewable energy company that's struggling right now that I happen to own some stock in, that never occurred to me until you just now brought that up. The answer is N-O, no. That's not what this is about. The amendment is an attempt to narrow this up for people who had interest, people from the environmental community, and it states very clearly that this is only for renewable electric energy. That's all it can be used for. In fact, if you read the whole list, many of those are connected with the word and, not or. And so this fund can only be expended by the advisor group and approved by the PUC, not this body. Now, that's one of the things we're trying to do is get it out of here so that people that are actually professionals at this can run this. And that's what it's for. I don't know how to make it any more clear for it. If you don't like the amendment, just vote no. But there is no other unintended consequence that's sneaking around here. I will be very emphatic about that.
Final comment, Representative Wagenius.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad Representative Beard brought up Bixby Energy, because I would have brought it up. But the amendment does not address the section I'm talking about, and it seems to me that Bixby could apply under the startup expansion and attraction of renewable energy projects and companies within the state. It seems to me that that language is extraordinarily broad and needs, after this discussion we've had here, needs to be narrowed considerably.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, the A2 amendment, Representative Hilty, is that your amendment? Sorry, Representative Knuth, is that?
Mr. Chair, I just, if you could help me understand the kind of, when we're taking testimony, and I have some general questions about the bill, and just, I'm just sort of curious what the sort of schedule for the next half hour or whatever this bill will take is.
Well, Representative Knuth, we have an agenda before us. We'd like to get through it today. This is the day we have scheduled for the energy bills. We have a number of things to get through. I'm trying to give everyone enough latitude to get their comments out, but we do have a long agenda. I'd like to finish up today before 10 o'clock.
Okay, so just, Mr. Chair, I have some questions about the bill generally, and are those going to be on the amendments or after the testimony? I'm just looking for a little direction.
I thought we were on amendments. I thought we'd clear up the amendments, and then we'd take testimony as needed. Representative Hilty, is that your amendment, the A2?
Mr. Chair, I don't wish to offer that amendment at
very good
this time.
Okay, then we will take testimony at this time.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have an oral amendment to offer.
Okay.
And I'll explain that then.
Representative Purcell?
I do have it written down. We didn't get it in time, though, but... It's on page 2, lines 17, 19, 21, 23, after the word electric, insert the words, and electric offsetting solar thermal. And if staff has that, then... I don't know if it needs to be repeated, but...
We'll have Mr. Eloff repeat it anyway.
As I understand Representative Purcell's amendment, on line, page 2, line 17, after electric, insert, and electric offsetting solar thermal. Page 2, line 19, after the word electric, insert, and electric offsetting solar thermal. Line 221... after electric, the same, and line 223 also the same, insert, and electric offsetting solar thermal.
Yes.
And that's correct, Representative Purcell. And
yes.
Representative Knuth, you'd like to speak to that?
I as well.
Well, if Representative Purcell wants to speak to his amendment first.
Speak to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to explain briefly what I'm trying to do here, in the spirit of the renewable development account, the fund, I'd like to have this language in there, and again talking about companies within the state, and we talk about that in these lines that I'm referencing here for amendment. The opportunity to put electric solar thermal and utilize that. We have companies in this state that do produce these solar thermal. They're used as offsetting electricity, and we've been able to combine these with small grants up in my neck of the woods to assist on low-income housing heating projects, and it's been very effective, but kind of hit and miss. But then again, that pays us back if we're offsetting. You know, we use our taxpayer dollars for low-income heating, every year. And these solar thermal furnaces, these solar furnaces, are, you know, they're good for 30 years. So we make that investment put these on these low-income heated homes, and we get a better bang for our buck. Going out and looking for grant money here and there, and this would be a good opportunity for those of us in Minnesota to really put up some funds, opportunities anyway. They'd have to apply for these, of course, but be eligible and could save ourselves some tax money in the long run. And that's the impetus behind this. The fact that this small company happens to be right next door to my district has nothing to do with it. But they are a good small company employing Minnesotans. And it's been hit and miss for us over the last 10, 12 years with this, but it is coming on. Folks are starting to realize the importance of and the utility of solar thermal. So that's my amendment.
And Representative Knuth, did you want to speak at this time? Or?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to hear Representative Purcell's reasoning for the amendment. And I think the amendment refers to, I think, a bigger issue with the bill in front of us. And I appreciate Representative Purcell wanting to expand to offsetting solar thermal. But, there's a lot of other renewable energy technologies that aren't renewable electric energy. And I know Xcel's a utility, although they are a gas and electric utility. And to limit this fund, and I think this is one of the most exciting funds in the state of Minnesota because it actually helps us meet one of the biggest challenges of the 21st century. I'm not sure limiting it to renewable electric energy technologies and not really even having a definition of what that would be is the right way to go with the fund. And I think expanding it to solar thermal is great, but I'm thinking my own house, previous owner put in three different solar tubes so I can shower without turning on the lights, which isn't a renewable electric technology, but it certainly reduces my energy bills every month because I don't have to turn on the lights in rooms that don't have any windows. And, there's all sorts of different ways of reducing energy use and or using energy in different ways that may not fit into a definition of renewable electric energy. I don't want to speak against Representative Purcell's amendment, but I think adding on these little kind of carve-outs for different technologies may not be the best way. It might just be get rid of electric and the renewable electric energy resource or description in each of these definitions, and I'd be curious what the author would think about that and the justification for having the word electric in there to begin with.
Representative Beard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives, for the chance to talk about the amendment. Representative Knuth's comment on the overarching purpose of the bill actually strikes at the core of what the bill is about. Members, over the last 18 years now, we've had a fund that's generated $180-some million, and it's like every time the legislature gets together, we think of something new to do with the fund. It is a fund, to be clear, that's extracted from ratepayers of Xcel Energy. These are people who are buying one product and one product only, and that's electricity. And the nature of the discussions it has been that if we're taking it from electrical users, it should go to a purpose that replaces electricity or creates electricity in some other fashion that we find interesting, appealing, and useful. Electric or solar can apply if it actually generates electricity and if it's in a demonstration or near commercial position to come into the marketplace. That's the purpose of the A1 amendment. But the representative is exactly right. For years, we have come along with and carved out little things all over the place that really kind of muddied the water on what the fund's all about. This bill is an attempt to make it clear, bring it back into focus. And, Mr. Chairman, it's not that solar has gotten short shrift in this legislature out of this very fund. In fact, there are $5 million payments per year, and I believe we have two more years to run that are aimed specifically at Minnesota-made solar programs. So there's another $10 million to route into the marketplace to kind of help solar get a toehold and become commercially viable so that they stand on their own. In addition, the Conservation Improvement Program, which applies to all utilities in this state, and has this bill has nothing to do with that. This bill doesn't touch the CIP program at all. There are millions of dollars a year in payments being made to the solar industry from that program, but again, that's very specifically to solar panels that actually create electricity. I think even the CIP program probably doesn't touch thermal, hot air type solar. Something that back in the 70s, when I was a student at Bible College, one of the things we did was we had 22 patents on hot air solar panels that we created because in those days the administration in Washington had made a commitment to the American people that by the year 2000, 20% of our energy would come from solar power, and we spent $6 billion in the interim trying to make that happen. So I think solar has some legs and it has some funds of money that touch it, so I'd speak against the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just partially related to the amendment, but kind of the same general area we're talking about. So on the number four on line 2.23 and 2.24, to develop near commercial and demonstration scale renewable electric or electric infrastructure efficiency projects. I mean, that's the only place in here where I think efficiency is referred to. And I appreciate electric infrastructure efficiency, but I'm guessing, I'm not sure because it's not clear in the language. You're talking about the overall electric infrastructure. Are you talking about these smaller scales, maybe personal level or home level, some of the things that might have covered SIP, but not necessarily? And is the only place you're looking at efficiency here in electric infrastructure? Could you just explain that a little bit more? And I think it would be narrowing it, I think, to a level that wouldn't be good for this account, because efficiency is so important. You know, the cheapest energy is the energy we don't have to produce. And so I'm just, could you comment a little bit on the efficiency component of this, because that's the only place in these in the purpose statements that I'm seeing the word efficiency, unless I'm missing it somewhere else.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman and members, we have volumes of law concerning the Conservation Improvement Program, which deals with efficiency projects. This bill, with this public utilities ratepayers in this environment, this very tightly focused deal, it still says that we can do things to the energy grid that make it more efficient. That's who benefits from this. One of the points the auditor brought up, that is dressed kind of, you know, obliquely in this bill, is that if spending this money all over the state is a good idea, then this tax should apply to everybody in the state, not just to the ratepayers of Xcel Energy. That's why this is tightened down to only this public utilities ratepayers and to things that actually could put money into this grid and benefit these ratepayers. Efficiency, if there's some infrastructure efficiency, I'm thinking of the demonstration project by my house in Shakopee, where we pulled the 3M Wonder Wire, or Xcel Energy actually did, which cut line loss substantially. Those are projects that could fit. But other than that, no, this is very tightly crafted, and the author is not interested in expanding it beyond that.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're running a little bit afield of the amendment, but I think it is a really important point, because efficiency is a potentially very beneficial thing to ratepayers, and Xcel's been really good at it. I mean, I need to compliment them. They've done a nice job under the SIP program, but to think that we couldn't use RDF money to research better efficiency technologies or promote expansion and attraction of efficiency or conservation businesses, develop, the commercial demonstration that depends on what types of efficiencies, but the whole reason, one of the ways we can actually make renewable electricity work is to reduce the demand overall and couple these two. It's a really important part of the penetration of electric energy of renewable energy technologies into our energy system. And to explicitly leave them out of this fund, I don't think makes a lot of sense. Either for Xcel or for the Xcel ratepayers. And this is on another point, but The RDF fund is not a tax. It's and we could have a whole bunch of philosophical discussions about what the RDF fund is and in the history of it. And I wasn't here, and but from the stories I've been told, it was one of the tensest times this capital has ever seen. One of my colleagues who was on the conference committee talks about having a security detail during that time, and it's XL ratepayers benefiting from the nuclear energy in their utilities company's portfolio and paying for the risk that storage brings to the state of Minnesota. So the whole state is taking up that risk. And I've been guilty of going back and forth whether or not this money should be spent within XL ratepayer territory or not, but it's not about a tax on XL ratepayers. It's paying for a certain amount of risk that XL brings to the state with its nuclear waste storage. And I think that's pretty clear, even more so when you look at the fact that a dry cask at the Prairie Island power plant costs more than a dry cask at the Monticello plant. And Prairie Island's on the Mississippi River, and it's really close to the Mississippi River, and thinking about the risk associated with that versus being up in Monticello, at least that's my guess as to why those two are significantly different every year. But so that we're trying to move Minnesota to 21st century energy system, and the RDF is a big part of that, and part of it comes out of the people of Minnesota having to take on a certain level of risk by having nuclear power generation. And so that's another side point, I guess, for the whole discussion of the bill. And you know, I know, Mr. Chair, you probably want to get through, but you know, one day of bills on energy when we're looking at one of the biggest challenges of this century, I think is a fairly short amount of time. So I'm just going to keep asking the questions, and wanted to just make the point about, one, the efficiency, why it would be so limited to only the electric infrastructure efficiency when the other types of efficiency XL has demonstrated are extremely beneficial and save a lot of money. You know, not having to build a new baseload power plant because of efficiency is hugely beneficial to the ratepayers. And just some concern about the narrow definition of renewable electric energy, because when the focus is on production, that's what our utilities deliver. And when we also expand the focus to conservation and efficiency and then production to fill the resulting need, I think we'll get a better outcome. And I would hope that the author might reconsider that with this bill moving forward.
To the Purcell Oral Amendment, Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I did not want to address the amendment. I have some comments about the bill in general, but actually I was hoping to hear the testimony of the people that wanted to testify before I got to those remarks. So it's not about the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, you were on the list. Apparently you raised your hand during the amendment. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to ask support for my amendment. And my amendment is about a Minnesota company employing Minnesotans, Minnesota jobs, right now, today. That's what it's about. And I ask for support on that.
Representative Wagenius, to the amendment.
Yes, let's have a roll call on that one, please.
Representative Wagenius requests a roll call on the Purcell Oral Amendment. Any further discussion? Okay, clerk will take the roll.
Hackbarth?
No.
McNamara?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Beard?
Nay.
Dill? Druskowski? Fabian?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hancock?
No.
Hansen? Hilty?
No.
Knuth?
Yes.
Purcell?
Yes.
Quam?
No.
Scott?
No.
Torkelson? Wagenius?
Yes.
There being 9 nays and 4 yeses, the amendment is not adopted. Okay, to the bill. Let's see. Okay, we're going to bring up, let's see, Ben Gerber, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, to start with. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Ben Gerber, I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just wanted to say a few things. A lot has changed since 1994. What we've seen is a large increase in rate cases, and we've also seen that the renewable energy industry has become more effective and efficient. But more importantly, the businesses that I represent are facing a competitive business environment with a lot of their competition coming from global competitors. What we saw through the OLA report is that the RDF fund is not held to acceptable transparency and accountability standards, rarely provides a direct benefit to the people who pay for it, and that's the Xcel energy ratepayers. And we believe that it's important that if they're going to be paying for it, that there should be some direct benefit. When you look at the Rockefeller Brookings Institution did a great study at looking at some of these other funds across the country. A lot of them are run differently. Ours is unique in that Xcel, it's a private company that holds the fund, and the legislature is appropriating money out of that fund. But when you look at the amount of add-on investment and jobs that were created compared to what we see here, we're at a significant disadvantage. And so we really think that it's important that the legislature take a hard look at how these other funds are done in other states. If you look at California PEER program, the New York State program, and the Massachusetts program, all have significant advantages over the way our successes over our program. So we think it's important that we look at those and remember that this is ratepayer money, and that we don't think that the businesses we represent have to be nimble to apply for these funds, and we think that it's appropriate that everybody that does, and that there shouldn't be carve-outs for specific institutions or corporations or specific areas of energy. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gerber, can you tell me how much a business pays on a monthly or annual basis to support this fund? Can you give me one example, or how many cents per kilowatt hour this costs?
Gerber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Falk, I don't have a specific number right now, but when you look at especially the large users in Xcel's territory, it's significant. So, even if it's 0.5% or less than that, that equals real dollars and real jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think if you look at it, it's quite infinitesimally small, but that's, once again, a subjective thing. Is it the Chamber's position that nuclear power is supposedly more affordable, more cost-effective, cheaper power?
Gerber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Falk, I think you're referencing another position about removing the nuclear moratorium. Our position on that is that we shouldn't be picking and choosing, and all options should be on the table.
Representative Falk?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Gerber, I've heard asserted by your organization before, not specifically by you, but that nuclear power is a low-cost alternative. I disagree with that assertion, but if that premise is to be believed, then, and there are substantial risks associated with it, as Representative Knuth alluded to, all of Xcel's ratepayers have benefited for a significant period of time by having those assets into the rate schedule. This small amount of money that is, I think, far too small for the concurrent risk that our entire state takes. It doesn't matter if you are a Great River Energy customer that's in a territory adjacent to Xcel's territory. If you have an incident at one of those facilities, is your health or your welfare not affected? Is it only going to be limited to the territory that is Xcel's? So if something like Fukushima happened, that radiation would stop at the Xcel territory and it would not affect Otter Tail or Great River Energy or any other cooperative. Is that the point that you're making?
Mr. Gerber.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, I don't believe I said anything to that extent. I mean, I'm not. I think the important thing is in the Senate Energy Committee, Senator Chair Rosen had a nuclear expert that came in and testified to the safety and reliability of the storage facilities, and I'm not an expert in that area. So, but you know, there has been information presented to the Senate at least that addresses some of those concerns.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My point is that to say that this unfairly burdens one utility is completely beyond the point. The purpose of why we have this is to go and have some countering of the risk the entire state bears for the storage of dry cask radioactive waste in the state of Minnesota. It's for that purpose. It's not to unduly burden one utility. It's because all Minnesotans bear that risk in some proportionality.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gerber. Mr. Hemmingson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dick Hemmingson, the Managing Director of the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment at the University of Minnesota. Members, you have a copy of the IRE annual report, which I know you've all seen before, and a longer statement, Mr. Chair, than I will give this morning. I will just hit a few of these highlights in my testimony this morning. Four really basic and I hope relatively brief points, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First of all, we feel as though innovation is always important, and we do have a choice to make as Minnesotans. Do we want to be a consumer of renewable energy technologies or a producer of new energy technologies? The choice we make in that regard will ultimately create more good jobs in Minnesota and have a longer-term foundation for a vibrant economy in the state. IRE has had a foundation of excellence in research and development, drawing together talents and institutions, and frankly, as a result of these investments, your University of Minnesota is now seen as the go-to place for renewable energy research, ranking with MIT, Berkeley, and many others. So looking forward, we believe that Minnesota should build on this success and continue to invest in innovation. And we urge you, the legislature, to designate a portion of the funds to support research and development of innovative energy technologies. Secondly, managing effective research and development is, in our opinion, a very different process than managing construction projects. And we have developed, we feel, a best-in-class process for soliciting, reviewing, managing research and development projects, and we urge the legislature to ensure that these R&D projects as part of this broader investment are managed appropriately, and we think separately from the traditional procurement activities. Thirdly, we do have in Minnesota a Silicon Valley opportunity. All the right pieces are here. We have abundant natural resources. We have many businesses, large and small, major strengths in human infrastructure at our research universities, at our other academic institutions, in our state and federal agencies. And we have, we think, begun to build an innovation ecosystem, starting with the R&D community and moving it more broadly into the business and NGO and government community. So much more effort is needed here, and we urge the legislature to keep this in mind as you reauthorize the Renewable Development Fund. And finally, point four, as we move forward with the RDF, we should take a visionary and a coordinated approach. We do agree and said so at the time the legislative auditor's report was released about better coordination, better clarity, although I would add and would encourage you to take a look at the statute that does clarify and specifically state what the research and development areas of opportunity have been for IRE. We paid strict attention to that. So moving forward, we think the redesign of the RDF should include a dedicated program for R&D and renewable energy systems, that it builds on the success of existing investments, that the process be nimble and effective to take advantage of emerging opportunities and be cooperatively managed in a coordinated strategy with the RDF. IRE, the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, has a proven track record of its success, and we at the University of Minnesota stand ready to be an active partner in the next phase of the RDF. And if I may comment very briefly on the report that Mr. Gerber called to your attention, the Brookings Institution report. When you look at that, I'd encourage you to look at another of that report's findings, which says, and I quote, "State Clean Energy Fund's emphasis on a project finance model, which directly promotes clean energy project installation by providing production incentives and grants and rebates, is by itself not enough to build a statewide clean energy industry. State clean energy funds also need to pay attention to other critical aspects of building a robust clean energy industry, including clean tech innovation support through research and development funding." Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for your testimony. Great tie, by the way.
Thank you.
Let's see. Bill Grant. Commissioner Grant. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent
for the
record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. I want to start by thanking Representative Beard for his work on this bill. It follows some good work in the Senate, Senator Rosen and her colleagues, in putting this bill together. I think it's, for the most part, addresses the issues that have been raised by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And there's no reason at this point, save for two issues that I'll raise, that I think the bill is ready to move forward in this form. And let me go to those. The first is the issue that is addressed by the A1 amendment, and we feel that the A1 language moves the bill closer in the direction that we would hope. We remain concerned, though, Mr. Chair and members, that without further restriction to renewable electric projects, that the electric energy infrastructure efficiency projects could take on a rather wide scope, and we're concerned about that. I appreciate Representative Knuth's points. However, there's a lot of work to be done, as you've heard, in the development of the renewable energy industry here in Minnesota. Even though this, certainly in my terms, is a lot of money, in the world of developing renewable energy systems and technologies and the research and development to support that, this is not a lot of money. I'm afraid that opening the fund to other efficiency-related activities, while meritorious in their own regard, is a deviation from what this fund should be focused on, and I think has been focused on since its inception. The second point that I'll make is that on the subject of research and development, we do believe that research and development is a very important component of a fund's efforts like this, and again has been a significant part of the Renewable Development Fund's activities over its history, and some of the most exciting projects that the fund has invested in have in fact been R&D type of projects. I do believe that we're close to a solution that works for the major research institution in the state as well as other research institutions in the state. I hope that we continue to work on that as the bill continues its path forward, and certainly the department is willing and anxious to be a part of helping that make the finish line, Mr. Chairman. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Okay, on our list is some things up here. We have Representative Hilty and Representative Falk on the list so far. Representative Hilty.
Well, Mr. Chair, nothing in my experience suggests to me that this bill isn't going to pass out of this committee, and considering that we have other bills in the agenda that have some importance, I think I'm just going to reserve my comments for the House floor.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hilty. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a few concerns with the bill as drafted, because we have an advisory committee that's supposed to go and give direction for these expenditures, yet it's really has no means to really enforce any of those actions, and utility can do as it really sees fit. I think this is kind of contrary to some of the testimony we heard, because I think one of the quotes was, things can only be expended by the advisory group, or we are giving this we are going to run this through the advisory group process. But when you read the bill language, it's actually not the case. And so if we're really truly going to have an advisory commission or committee that actually can do things, I think it's important to have this bill reflect that. So on line 2.31, I would move to strike the words, if agreed to by the public utility.
Mr. Eloff, you have that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
What lines are we striking again here, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Eloff?
Line 2.31, strike, comma, if agreed to by the public utility, comma.
Mr. Chairman, I'd speak against it for this reason. The language that we have here basically codifies the work that was done years ago on their own after the direction of this legislature. It's been working well for 18 years. Basically, we've just put into statute what they've been doing in practice. And, Mr. Chairman, I might point out that the advisory committee works well with the utility that's actually generating the fund and still holding the fund in its private account, I might point out. But that before any funds are appropriated or authorized, it has to be approved by the Public Utility Commission. To be clear, the PUC is the final arbiter of the awards. Mr. Chairman, I think it's unnecessary, and I'd speak against the amendment.
Representative Falk?
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, to that point, I mean, this is the part that's saying that any changes must be agreed to by the public utility. Mm-hmm. So, ultimately, you're saying that if the commission wants to modify something or the advisory committee wants to offer a different take on things, really they can do that, but ultimately the utility can just do it as they see fit. Once again, I mean, there's greater implications here. This resource exists, this fund exists because the entire state is put at risk because of the actions of one utility. Now, we've allowed that to happen, but we have to have a much broader discussion, and there needs to be broader input, because who here is speaking on behalf of citizens, communities? I don't even believe that there's a member of the Prairie Island Indian community on this advisory committee. Maybe I am mistaken, but I believe that was one of the cases. And for the community that's most closely affected by this dry cask storage, wouldn't it be prudent to at least have a member of that community on the advisory committee? I mean, that just seems like common sense. And so I'm going to ask for a roll call on this, because I do think that this is a very important thing and that we need to have the ability for there to be modifications to what the utility deems it's appropriate versus the balancing of what's appropriate to the entire state.
Representative Falk requests a roll call on his oral amendment. Any further discussion? Clerk will take the roll.
Hackbarth?
No.
McNamara?
No.
Anderson? Beard?
Nay.
Bill? Druskowski?
No.
Fabian?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hancock?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Hilty?
Aye.
Knuth?
Yes.
Purcell?
Yes.
Quam? Scott?
No.
Torkelson? Wiginius?
There being six yes and eight no's, the amendment is not adopted. Further discussion, Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a number of questions. I think Mr. Evans is probably the best person, Representative Beard. So this advisory group has a fair amount of power, and the only representative that's required to be on the advisory group is a representative of ratepayers. And honestly, I feel like anyone could be a representative of the ratepayers. You know, I got my Excel bill yesterday and looked at it and looked at the details of it, and I could serve as a ratepayer, and I think everyone around the table could serve as a ratepayer. And so I'm just curious why that's the only group that's singled out, and And I think Representative Falk brought up a good point in terms of a member from the Prairie Island community. And I'm, could you help me understand this advisory group? And I, a few specific questions. One, who picks them? You know, if we're going to give them this sort of power over a fund that you could call public or not public, sort of a unique fund, but one that I think there's a lot of public interest in how it's used. So who picks the advisory group, and what kind of criteria are used? What kind of balance is tried to be achieved? What sort of independence, if Excel's picking the advisory group, you know, how long are their terms? What sort of safeguards to keep them on there so they can make independent decisions from Excel? And just could you, because it's really not spelled out in the legislation, could you help me understand this advisory group? And I don't have an amendment today, but I was also curious if Representative Beard would be open to more clearly spelling out some of the makeup of this group and some of their perhaps qualifications or some comfort language in terms of their independence from Excel. We've dealt a lot with advisory boards and in this legislature, and we generally put quite a bit of specifics in statute in terms of defining the makeup and the criteria that who's going to appoint, and none of that is in this bill, which leaves me concerned. So, Mr. Evans, if you could explain what you see, and then if Representative Beard would help, would let me know if he's open to working a little bit more on this advisory group language.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Knuth, when the first RDF provision was passed in 1994, it provided absolutely no guidance as to how the fund would be operated. It just created the fund. In 1999, the fund first started collecting money under the law, and Excel and members of the legislature, many people in the environmental community who had championed this, had to sit down and figure out how to actually do this. And so it was in that process, in 1999, I believe, the legislature gave the Public Utilities Commission the authority to set up a process by which this would be done. Since that time, there have been a number of PUC orders, the stack's about 3 inches thick. One of those orders sets up the advisory group, advises who should be on it. There is a member of the Prairie Island Indian community on the advisory group, as well as representatives of business interests, representative of environmental interests. I'll probably miss some, but I know currently the advisory group is made up of a representative of Fresh Energy, of the Isaac Walton League, of the Division of Energy Resources, of the Chamber of Commerce, and the Prairie Island Indian community, and representatives from Xcel Energy. To be quite frank about it, our preference as Xcel would have been to have no reference to the advisory group in the statute at all. Our concern is we don't want the advisory group to become a state agency. This is not state money they're dealing with. This is private money, and our preference was to try to keep the advisory group out of the statute, let it be controlled by the Public Utilities Commission as it has been in the past, and operate under that function. It has, I think, all the members who've ever been on it would say it's operated in terrific good faith, almost always by consensus, possibly even always by consensus. It's been a good working group under the orders put together by the census. It's been a good working group under the orders put together by the Public Utilities Commission. We lost that debate in the Senate to the extent that they wanted to at least make reference to the fact that a ratepayer should be on it. But it doesn't change any of the PUC orders, and as you can see in line 2.36, continues to give authority to the Public Utilities Commission to make sure that the appropriate interests are represented on the advisory committee, on the advisory group. So the spare language was intentional, not quite spare enough for our interest, but that's the way it went, because we didn't want this to turn into a public board. And that was one of the things that was addressed by the auditor's report, by the way, was that this advisory group should either become a public agency or not, but that there should be more clarity. And to our way of thinking, the clarity is provided by the history of PUC orders that are still in effect that govern how that board operates, and that's the way we would prefer to go forward.
And let me just finish by repeating, this has been an extremely good group. They have worked together very well and have almost always operated by consensus. If we deviate from the advice of the advisory group, then when we go before the Public Utilities Commission, that is disclosed to them, and the members of the advisory group are entitled to get into the PUC and give their opinions as to why they disagreed on whatever the grant has been. But I don't believe in the history of the fund that's ever happened.
Representative Beard.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the short answer is probably not. I would not be interested in amending the bill any further. I know ratepayers went in there at insistence, and again, as it was mentioned, it was specifically, we're trying to codify practice that's actually worked, and as the auditor has pointed out, worked rather well, even absent direction from the legislature on how to do this. So rather than gum up the works with putting in all kinds of whatever our favorite phrase is today and favorite interest group, we were going to just leave it totally up to the PUC and codify what they've done and made it very clear in statute that it's their responsibility. I'd prefer it stay that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that, Representative Beard. And Mr. Evans, that was very helpful in terms of understanding this group, because that's not totally clear in this language. And so, there's nowhere, unless I'm missing it, I don't see any reference to the PUC's decisions about who makes up this board and the process for selection in this bill. And maybe I'm missing it, so you could point it out. That would be really helpful. And then a specific question for Mr. Evans, just in terms of the kind of expertise that this group has, and I understand there's been a lot of good work done, and that's great. What sort of expertise does the group have in terms of making research requests for proposals versus more sort of right now we have IRE and we have Excel and we have the legislature using this money in different ways. So, and you know, it's understandably confusing and does need some clarification. But I do think there is a distinct difference between running a research group versus more of the advisory group that Excel has had. And could you help me understand how much this group has thought about that and how much Excel has thought about that in terms of its ability and its expertise in implementing more of a research agenda than what this group maybe has done? Because, you know, switching it all into this one group does limit the expertise a little bit. I mean, it makes it less complicated, but it also, at the same time, limits the expertise and the experience that other groups have brought. So I guess there's two questions. One, could you help me understand where the PUC is referenced in terms of this advisory group? And two, that's from Representative Beard and Mr. Evans, if you could help me understand the expertise and experience in terms of this group running a research program.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knuth, the expenditure authorization starts on line 2.27, paragraph E. How the group is made up, that is implied in line paragraph F, starting on 2.34, specifically line 2.36. It says the commission may require that other interests be represented on the advisory group. And then it goes on to define what the advisory group does and so on and so forth in the rest of paragraph F. That's specifically where the PUC has the authority to require the makeup of the group. Mr. Chairman, I might point out, too, there's been chatter about IRE here. This changes the nature of the funding of IRE, and we're not just going to give them block grants from this group, but IRE is able to and encouraged to apply to the same group, just like every other proposer. When requests for proposals go out, IRE, I'm sure, is going to be on that list and is welcome to make application to the group. We just aren't going to have two sets of administration and one at the university doing their thing. They'll all come through this group and through the PUC. That's the purpose of the bill.
Very good. Representative Knuth, anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that clarification, Representative Beard. And just, Mr. Evans, if you could comment on this group's experience and Excel's experience in terms of research funding.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, the process that Excel goes through with the RDF advisory group is they design a request for proposals that is reviewed by the PUC and then distributed through various channels that reach the people who would be proposing for this kind of thing. The proposals come in and are sent to a firm, and I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on the name of the firm, but it is a firm that is experienced in examining technical proposals, and they score the proposals for the group. They don't make recommendations, but they apply scores based on a set of criteria that have been put together. And those then come back to the advisory group with the scores to evaluate the proposals and to make recommendations for what should be placed before the Public Utilities Commission. We have been, since in the Senate, engaged in some conversation with the University of Minnesota about how a more academic peer review type of process might work. And we're continuing, as Commissioner Grant said, to continue to talk with them about how we can accommodate their concerns for that kind of review, which is, as I understand it, and I have no experience in it, but my understanding is it's somewhat different than the kind of review that our technical group gives at the firm that we employ. So we're continuing to work with them, and hope we'll be able to come to a resolution that will cover both. I will say that, it was last year, and I can't name names or count votes, but it was actually members of the legislature last year who asked us to try to focus more on practical, on-the-ground kind of applications and less on pure research, and that was part of what directed this bill the way it went, though the pure research is still not prevented in any way by this bill, and hopefully with working with the university, we'll be able to enhance that somewhat to their satisfaction.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I must say that I do stand corrected. There is a member of the Prairie Island Indian community on the advisory board. I guess my concern still is that there isn't the requirement that a member of that community be on the board. I still have major concerns. I've got questions for Mr. Evans. Mr. Evans, who appoints the advisory board?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, you know, the advisory board members are, and including the Prairie Island Indian Tribe, are required by PUC order. I don't frankly know, and I'm afraid I'll have to defer to Commissioner Grant to know exactly. Do the groups pick themselves? I mean, if the Prairie Island Indian group, they're recognized in the order, and so they select a representative to send, and the DER selects a representative to send. So the groups that are identified in the PUC order are then select their own representative to send to the advisory group.
Representative Falk. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. And that once again brings me to the concern I have. If we look at line 3.6, I'll just start reading the sentence. It says, the utility should attempt to reach agreement with the advisory group after consulting with it, but the utility has full and sole authority to determine which expenditures shall be submitted to the commission for commission approval. And so we're going to go and have the commission say that there have to be advisory groups. They're allowed to advise, but they really don't have any ultimate say because, as this language says, the utility has full and sole authority to determine which expenditures shall be submitted. And perhaps the way that's the way the status quo exists, but I don't think that's the way it should. And so, Mr. Chairman, I would move to actually strike the words should attempt to reach and insert must on line 3.6. And on line 3.7, strike the words, after consulting with it, but the utility has full and sole authority. So if Mr. Eloff would be so kind as to read that back when he's ready.
Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me read the way I think you want it to read and tell me if I'm correct or not. The utility must reach agreement with the advisory group to determine which expenditures shall be submitted to the commission for commission approval?
That's correct. Thank you. If we're going to actually have an advisory group, and it's going to be made up of these diverse interests who obviously have played a significant important role in this process, then let's make this be an actual functioning advisory board that actually can legitimately advise. For this, Mr. Chairman, I'd also ask for a roll call.
Representative Falk requests a roll call on his oral amendment. further discussion? Representative Purcell?
Mr. Chair, could you repeat the line that we're amending again?
Mr. Eloff?
I'll read it as amended, Mr. Chair. Line 3.6, the utility must reach agreement with the advisory group to determine which expenditures shall be submitted to the commission for commission approval.
Clerk, call roll. Chair votes no.
McNamara?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Beard?
No.
Dill?
Yes.
Druskowski?
No.
Fabian?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hancock?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Hilty?
Yes.
Knuth?
Yes.
Purcell?
Yes.
Quam? Scott?
No.
Torkelson?
No.
Wagenius?
Being 7 yes and 9 no's, the amendment is not adopted. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard woke up this morning and read the paper and saw that Excel had spent $2.36 million last year on lobbying the legislature. Is there anything in statute that expressly prohibits the RDF funds from being used for any lobbying? Is that in statute anywhere?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that it is, but Mr. Evans can speak to that. I would point out that $2.6 million includes an enormous amount of time spent at the PUC. That it, they have to be there for rate cases and all kinds of stuff where I think the majority of the dollars are spent. Is it in statute that prohibits the RDF fund? I think it would be precluded because this is specifically for electric generation, Representative Hansen, so I don't even need Mr. Evans to speak to that. The answer is no.
Mr. Evans, any comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't know of anything in the bill that would permit us to anyone to apply for lobbying expenses. You know, certainly we have budgets for lobbying expenses, so it's there's no necessity to go to the RDF to get money for that. I guess I would also point out that lobbying expenses by federal practice and state practice are what we call below the line. In other words, we don't build our lobbying expenses into our rates. We're not permitted to. When we have a rate case, they're excluded. So it just, I guess there's nothing in here that specifically precludes it, but I really don't see how that would be necessary. I can't see that passing muster at any stage of the game.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to make a comment that if we're going to start pointing out how much lobbyists are paid for different things, then maybe we should look at the University of Minnesota and how much they pay their lobbyists to lobby on energy issues.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Representative Beard, as you know, I always read through your bills carefully, and I appreciate the diligent work you've put into this. I guess one concern I also have is on page 3, starting at 3.31, it says, all final reports must acknowledge that the project was made possible in whole or part by the Minnesota Renewable Development Fund, noting that the fund is financed by the public utilities ratepayers. Well, that is accurate in one sense, but we also have to acknowledge the fact that why does this fund exist? And we all know that it came out of a 1994 agreement that allowed dry cask radioactive waste to be stored in state for an indefinite period of time. And so this was an agreement that allowed one utility to go and put money into this fund in exchange for that privilege. It's not a right, it's a privilege. And so when we're stating that these reports must acknowledge the ratepayers' money is paying for them, I think it's also important to note that that money is coming from the result of a privilege of allowable behavior. And that's very clear. We have to be telling the whole truth here. It's not just ratepayers' money, but it's becoming because of a result of an action. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'd also move to insert the words in line 3.32 after fund created as a result of the storage of nuclear waste in this state. I believe Mr. Eloff has that as well, and if you'd be so kind as to read that back.
Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Representative Falk will oblige. I originally gave him that language, but on looking at this again, I think it can be improved on. Let me read this. After the word ratepayers on line 3.33, insert "and was created as a result of the storage of nuclear waste in this state." That would be required to be noted in the final report.
Representative Falk, is that what you'd like?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eliff, I am agreeable to that. I would move that amendment and ask for a roll call.
Representative Falk, ask for a roll call on his oral amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, I could further amend it and say made necessary because of the dereliction of the federal government and their political decision not to do Yucca Mountain. We could have a discussion of whether it's waste or whether it's spent fuel, which all the rest of the legislation refers to this as spent nuclear fuel, and so on and so forth. Mr. Chairman, just vote no on this amendment.
Clerk, call the roll. Chairman votes no. McNamara?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Beard?
Nay.
Dill?
Yes.
Druskowski?
No.
Fabian?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hancock?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Hilty?
Yes.
Knuth?
Yes.
Purcell?
Yes.
Quam? Scott?
No.
Torkelson?
No.
Wagenius? There being seven yes, and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Beard, would you like to renew your motion that House File 2650 be recommended to pass and be moved to the General Register?
As amended.
As amended.
Please, yes, thank you.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, motion prevails.
No.
Your bill is on the way to the General Register. Representative Torkelson, we're going to move your bill really quick, House File 2730. Representative Torkelson moves House File 2731 to be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. We only have a few minutes to talk about the bill and get the bill passed. Representative Torkelson, I'm going to move right away the A2 amendment. I think you're agreeable to the amendment. Is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair. The Gay 2 Amendment puts the bill in the same shape that the Senate has it and makes a couple technical corrections.
All in favor of the A2 Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Torkelson, you have some brief comments, and we'd like to vote and take some questions if there are any, and get out of here by 10 o'clock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a search bill. I have testifiers.
Keep it brief.
3 minutes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lissa Polish. I'm the statewide first director with the University of Minnesota Extension and the Regional Sustainable Development Partnership.
And I'm just tell us what the bill does, and we'll wrap it up.
Okay. This bill continues funding for the Clean Energy Resource Teams program. It's a statewide program designed to help communities identify and implement community-scale energy efficiency and renewable energy programs.
Thank you. Any questions of the members? Okay, I have to renew the motion that it's going to be sent to Ways and Means. Okay, all in favor of the Representative Torkelson renews his motion that House File 2731, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed and sent to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, members. We missed a number of bills today that we're going to have to get to and find some other time for. So with that, members, I'm meeting adjourned.